became not so much a skill as an instinct to them. They were the ones who became the champions, the swordmasters. Experienced warriors like Sir Rodney and Sir Carol were expert swordsmen, but naturals took the skill to a higher plane. It was as if, for them, the sword in their hand became a true extension, not just of their bodies, but of their personalities as well. The sword seemed to act in instant communion and harmony with the natural's mind, acting even faster than conscious thought. Naturals were possessed of unique skills in timing and balance and rhythm. As such, they presented a heavy responsibility to those who were entrusted with their training. For those natural skills and abilities had to be carefully nurtured and developed in a long-term training program to allow the warrior, already highly proficient as a matter of course, to develop his true potential for genius.
"You're sure?"
Carol said eventually, and Rodney nodded again, his gaze out the window. In his mind, he was seeing the boy training, seeing those extra flickers of lightning-fast movement.
"I'm sure," he said simply. "We'll have to let Wallace know that he'll have another pupil next semester."
Wallace was the swordmaster at the Redmond Battle School. He was the one who had the responsibility for adding the final polish to the basic skills that Carol and the others taught. In the event of an outstanding trainee, as Horace obviously was, he would give them private instruction in advanced techniques. Carol curled his bottom lip thoughtfully, as he thought about the time frame Rodney had suggested.
"Not until then," he said.
The next semester was almost 3 months away.
"Why not get him started straight away? From what I saw, he's already mastered the basic stuff."
But Rodney shook his head.
"We haven't really assessed his personality yet," he said. "He seems a nice enough lad, but you never know. If he turns out to be a misfit of some kind, I don't want to give him the sort of advanced instruction that Wallace can provide."
Once he thought of it, Carol agreed with the battlemaster. After all, if it should turn out that Horace had to be disqualified from battle school because of some other failing, it might be embarrassing, not to mention dangerous, if he were already on the road to being a highly trained swordsman. Disqualified trainees often reacted with resentment.
"And another thing," Rodney added. "Let's keep this to ourselves and tell Morton the same. I don't want the boy hearing any word of this yet. It might make him cocky, and that could be dangerous for him."
"That's true enough," Carol agreed. He finished the last of his beer in two quick draughts, set his tankard down on the table and stood.
"Well, I'd better be getting along. I've got reports to finish." "Who hasn't?"
the battlemaster said with some feeling, and the two old friends exchanged rueful grins.
"I never knew there was so much paper involved in running a battle school."
Carol snorted in derision.
"Sometimes I think we should forget the weapons training and just throw all the paper at the enemy, bury them in it."
He gave an informal salute, just touching one finger to his forehead, that was in keeping with his seniority. Then he turned and headed for the door. He paused as Rodney added one last point to their discussion.
"Keep an eye on the boy, of course," he said, "but don't let him become aware of it."
"Of course," Carol replied.
"We don't want him to start thinking there's something special about him."
At that moment, there was no chance that Horace would think there was anything special about him. At least, not in any positive sense. What he did feel was that there was something about him that attracted trouble. Word had gone around about the strange scene at the training ground. His classmates, not understanding what had happened, all assumed that Horace had somehow annoyed the battlemaster, and now waited for the inevitable retribution. They knew that the rule during the first semester was that, when one member of a class made a mistake, the entire class paid for it. As a result, the atmosphere in their dormitory had been strained, to say the least. Horace had finally made his way out of the room, intending to head for the river to escape the condemnation and blame he could feel from the others. Unfortunately, when he did so, he walked straight into the waiting arms of Alder, Bryn, and Jerome. The three older boys had heard a garbled version of the scene at the practice yard. They assumed that Horace had been criticised for his sword work, and decided to make him suffer for it. However, they knew that their attentions would not necessarily meet with the approval of the battle school staff. Horace, as a newcomer, had no way of knowing that this sort of systematic bullying was totally disapproved of by Sir Rodney and the other instructors. Horace simply assumed that was the way things were supposed to be, and, not knowing any better, went along with it, allowing himself to be bullied and insulted. It was for this reason that the three second-year cadets marched Horace to the riverside, where he'd been heading anyway, and away from the sight of instructors. Here, they made him wade thigh-deep into the river, then stand to attention.
"Baby can't use his sword properly," said Alder.
Bryn took up the refrain.
"Baby made the battle master angry. Baby doesn't belong in battle school. Babies shouldn't be given swords to play with. Baby should throw stones instead."
Jerome concluded the sarcastic litany.
"Pick up a stone, baby."
Horace hesitated, then glanced around. The riverbed was full of stones, and he bent to get one. As he did so, his sleeve and the upper part of his jacket became soaked.
"Not a small stone, baby," Alder said, smiling evilly at him. "You're a big baby, so you need a big stone."
"A great big stone," Bryn added,
indicating with his hands that he wanted Horace to pick up a large rock. Horace looked around him and saw several larger pieces in the crystal clear water. He bent and retrieved one of them. In doing so, he made a mistake. The rock he chose was easy to lift under the water, but as he brought it above the surface, he grunted with the weight of it.
"Let's see it, baby," Jerome said. "Hold it up."
Horace braced himself. The swiftly running current of the river made it difficult to keep his balance and hold the heavy rock at the same time. Then he lifted it to chest height so his tormentors could see it.
"Right up, baby," Alder commanded. "Right over your head."
Painfully, Horace obeyed. The rock was feeling heavier by the second, but he held it high above his head and the three boys were satisfied.
"That's good, baby," Jerome said,
and Horace, with a relieved sigh, began to let the rock down again.
"What are you doing?" demanded Jerome angrily.
"I said that's good, so that's where I want the rock to stay."
Horace struggled and lifted the rock above his head once more, holding it at arm's length. Alder, Bryn and Jerome nodded their approval.
"Now you can stay there," Alder told him, "while you count to 500, then you can go back to the dormitory."
"Start counting," Bryn ordered him, grinning at the idea.
1, 2, 3, began Horace, but they all shouted at him almost immediately.
"Not so fast, baby. Nice and slowly. Start again."
1, 2, 3, Horace counted, and they nodded their approval.
"That's better. Now a nice, slow count to 500, and you can go," Alder told him.
"Don't try to fudge it, because we'll know," threatened Jerome, "and you'll be back here counting to 1,000.
Laughing among themselves, the three students headed back to their quarters. Horace remained in midstream, arms trembling with the weight of the rock, tears of frustration and humiliation filling his eyes. Once, he lost his balance and fell full length in the water. After that, his heavy, sodden clothing made it all the harder to hold the rock above his head, but he kept at it. He couldn't be sure that they weren't concealed somewhere, watching him.
And if they were, they'd make him pay for disobeying their instructions. If this was the way of things, then so be it, he thought. But he promised himself that, first chance he got, he was going to make somebody pay for the humiliation he was undergoing. Much later, clothes soaked, arms aching, and a deep feeling of resentment burning in his heart, he crept back to his quarters. He was too late for the evening meal, but he didn't care. He was too miserable to eat. 14.
Walk him around a little, said Holt.
Will glanced back at the shaggy pony, who watched him with intelligent eyes. Come on, boy, he said, and pulled on the halter. Instantly, Tug braced his forelegs and refused to move. Will pulled harder on the rope, leaning back in his efforts to make the stubborn little pony move. Old Bob cackled with laughter.
He be stronger than you, he said.
Will felt his ears reddening with embarrassment. He pulled harder. Tug twitched his ears and resisted. It was like trying to pull a house along.
Don't look at him, Holt said softly. Just take the rope and walk away from him. He'll follow.
Will tried it that way. He turned his back on Tug, seized the rope firmly, and began walking. The pony trotted easily after him. Will looked at Holt and grinned. The ranger nodded his head toward the far fence of the paddock. Will glanced across and saw a small saddle, placed across the top rail of the fence.
Saddle him up, said the ranger.
Tug clip-clopped docilely across to the fence. Will looped the reins around the fence rail and hefted the saddle across the pony's back. He bent down to fasten the girth straps of the saddle.
Pull them good and tight, old Bob advised him.
Finally, the saddle was firmly in position. Will looked eagerly at Holt. Can I ride him now? He asked. The ranger stroked his uneven beard thoughtfully before he answered.
If you feel that's a good idea, go ahead, he said finally.
Will hesitated for a moment. The phrase stirred a vague memory with him. But then eagerness overcame caution, and he put one foot in the stirrup and swung himself nimbly onto the pony's back. Tug stood, unmoving.
Get up, Will said,
drumming his heels against the pony's side. For a moment, nothing happened. Then Will felt a small tremor of movement go through the pony's body. Suddenly, Tug arched his muscular little back and shot straight into the air, all 4 feet leaving the ground at the same time. He twisted violently to one side, came down on his front legs, and kicked his rear legs high into the sky. Will sailed neatly over the pony's ears, turned a complete somersault in the air, and crashed on his back in the dirt. He picked himself up, rubbing his back. Tug stood nearby, ears up, watching him intently.
Now why did you go and do a silly thing like that? The eyes seemed to say.
Old Bob leaned against the fence, sides heaving with laughter. Will looked at Holt.
What did I do wrong? He asked.
Holt ducked under the fence rails and walked across to where Tug stood, watching the two of them expectantly. He handed the bridle back to Will, then laid one hand on his shoulder.
Nothing. If this were an ordinary horse, he said, but Tug has been trained as a ranger horse.
What's the difference? Will interrupted angrily, and Holt held his hand up for silence.
The difference is, each ranger horse has to be asked before a rider mounts him for the first time, said Holt. They're trained that way so that they can never be stolen.
Will scratched his head.
I've never heard of such a thing, he said.
Old Bob smiled as he walked forward.
Not too many folk have, he said. That's why ranger horses never get stolen.
Well, said Will, what do you say to a ranger horse before you mount him?
Holt shrugged. It varies from horse to horse,
Each one responds to a different request. He gestured toward the larger horse. My horse, for example, responds to the words, Permettez-moi. Permettez-moi? Will echoed. What sort of words are they?
They're Gaelic. They mean, will you allow me? His parents came from Gallica, you see, Holt explained.
Then he turned to old Bob.
What are the words for tog here, Bob?
Bob screwed up his eyes, pretending that he couldn't remember. Then his face cleared.
Oh, yes, we recall, he said. This un here, he needs to be asked, do you mind, afore you get on his back?
Do you mind? Will repeated, and Bob shook his head.
Don't say it to me, youngster. Say it in the horse's ear.
Feeling a little silly, and not at all sure that the others weren't having a joke at his expense, Will stepped forward and said softly in Tug's ear, Do you mind? Tug whinnied softly. Will looked doubtfully at the two men, and Bob nodded encouragement.
Go on. Climb on now. Young Tug won't harm me now.
Very carefully, Will swung himself onto the pony's shaggy back once again. His back still ached from the previous attempt. He sat there a moment. Nothing happened. Then he tapped his heels gently into Tug's ribs. Come on, boy, he said softly. Tug's ears twitched up, and he stepped forward at an easy walk. Still cautious, Will let him walk around the paddock once or twice, then tapped again with his heels. Tug broke into a gentle trot. Will moved easily to the rhythm of the horse's movement, and Holt looked on approvingly. The boy was an instinctive rider. The ranger unclipped the short length of rope that held the paddock gate closed and swung the wide gate open.
Take him out, Will, he called, and see what he can really do.
Obediently, Will turned the pony toward the gate and, as they passed through into the open ground beyond, tapped once more with his heels. He felt the muscular little body beneath him bunch momentarily. Then Tug broke into a fast gallop. The wind rushed past Will's ears as he leaned forward over the pony's neck, encouraging him to even greater speed. Tug's ears pricked upward in response, and he went even faster than before. He was like the wind. His short legs were a blur of motion as he carried the boy at full speed toward the edge of the trees. Gently, not sure how the pony would react, Will applied pressure to the left-hand rein. Instantly, Tug veered to the left, racing away from the trees at an angle. Will kept the gentle pressure on the rein until Tug was headed once again back toward the paddock. Will gasped in amazement as he saw how far they had come. Holt and old Bob were tiny figures in the distance now, but they grew rapidly larger as Tug flew over the rough grass toward them. A fallen log loomed in front of them, and before Will could make any effort to avoid it, Tug had gathered himself, steadied and leaped over the obstacle. Will let out a shout of excitement, and the pony whinnied briefly in reply. They were almost back to the paddock now, and Will pulled gently on both reins. Instantly, Tug slowed to a canter, then a trot, finally coming down to walking pace as Will maintained the pressure on the reins. He brought the pony to a standstill beside Holt. Tug tossed his shaggy head and whinnied again. Will leaned forward and patted the pony on the neck.
He's terrific, he said breathlessly. He's as fast as the wind.
Holt nodded gravely.
Perhaps not quite as fast as the wind, he said, but he can certainly cover ground.
He turned to the old man.
You've done well with him, Bob.
Old Bob ducked his head in appreciation and leaned forward to pat the shaggy little pony in his turn. He had spent his life breeding, training, and preparing the Ranger Corps horses, and this one ranked among the best he'd seen.
He'll keep that pace all day, he said fondly. Run them fat battle horses into the ground, this un will. Youngster rides him well too, Ranger, don't he?
Holt stroked his beard. Not too badly, he said.
Bob was scandalized.
Not too badly? You're a hard man, Ranger. Youngster sat him, light as a feather, through that jump.
The old man looked up at Will, sitting astride the pony, and nodded in appreciation.
He don't saw away at them reins like some do neither. Got a light touch with a horse's soft mouth, he has.
Will grinned at the old horse trainer's praise. He sneaked a quick look at Holt, but the ranger was as grave-faced as ever.
He never smiles, Will thought to himself.
He went to dismount, then stopped himself hurriedly.
Is there anything I should say to him before I get off?
Bob laughed aloud.
No, youngster. Once said, and young Tug here will remember, as long as it's you who's riding him.
Relieved, Will climbed down. He stood beside the pony, and Tug shoved him affectionately with his head. Will glanced at the apple barrel.
Could I give him another? He asked.
Holt nodded.
Just one more, he said. But don't go making a habit of it. He'll be too fat to run if you feed him all the time.
Tug snorted loudly. Apparently he and Holt were at odds over how many apples a pony should have in a day. Will spent the rest of the day getting tips on riding technique from old Bob, and learning how to look after and repair Tug's saddle and harness, as well as the finer points of caring for the little horse. He brushed and curried the shaggy coat until it shone, and Tug seemed to appreciate his efforts. Finally, worn out, his arms aching with the effort, he had slumped to a seat on a hay bale, which, of course, had to be the exact moment when Holt walked into the stable.
"Come along," he said. "No time to be lolling around, doing nothing. We'd best get moving if we're to be home before dark."
And, so saying, he tossed a saddle across the back of his horse. Will didn't bother to protest that he hadn't been lolling around, as the ranger put it. For a start, he knew it would be no use. And secondly, he was excited by the fact that they would be riding back to Holt's little cottage by the edge of the forest. It seemed that the two horses were to become a permanent part of their establishment. He realized now that Holt's horse had obviously been so before, and that the ranger had only been waiting until Will had shown his ability to ride and to bond with Tug, before reclaiming him from his temporary home in old Bob's stable. The horses whinnied to each other from time to time as they trotted back through the dim green forest, for all the world as if they were carrying on their own conversation. Will was bursting with questions he wanted to ask, but by now he was wary of chattering too much in the ranger's presence. Finally, he could contain himself no longer. "Halt," he said experimentally. The ranger grunted. Will took that as a sign that he could continue speaking. "What's your horse's name?" the boy asked. Holt looked down at him. His horse was slightly larger than Tug, although nowhere near the size of the giant battle horses kept in the Baron's stable.
"I believe it's Abelard," he said.
"Abelard?" Will repeated. "What kind of name is that?"
"It's Gaelic," said the ranger,
obviously putting an end to the conversation. They rode a few kilometres farther in silence. The sun was lowering over the trees now, and their shadows were long and distorted on the ground in front of them. Will studied Tug's shadow. The pony seemed to have enormously long legs and a ridiculously short body. He wanted to call Holt's attention to it, but thought that such a frivolous observation would not impress the ranger. Instead, he summoned the courage to ask another question that had been occupying his thoughts for some days. "Halt," he said again. The ranger sighed briefly.
"What now?" he asked.
His tone definitely did not encourage further conversation. However, Will pressed on. "Remember you told me how a ranger was responsible for Morgareth's defeat?" Holt grunted.
Well, I was just wondering, what was the ranger's name? The boy asked.
Names aren't important, Holt said. I really can't remember.
Was it you? Will continued, sure that it was. Holt turned that level, unsmiling gaze on him again.
I said, names aren't important, he repeated.
There was a silence between them for some seconds. Then the ranger said,
do you know what is important?
Will shook his head.
Supper is important, said the ranger, and we'll be late for it if we don't hurry.
He clapped his heels into Abelard's side, and the horse shot away like an arrow from Holt's own bow, leaving Will and Tug far behind in a matter of seconds.
Will touched Tug's sides with his own heels, and the little pony raced off in pursuit of his bigger friend.
Come on, Tug, Will urged. Let's show them how a real ranger horse can run.
15. Will rode Tug slowly through the crowded fairground that had been set up outside the castle walls. All the villagers and inhabitants of the castle itself seemed to be out, and he had to ride carefully to ensure that Tug didn't step on somebody's foot. It was harvest day, the day when all the crops had been gathered and stored for the winter months ahead. After a hard month of harvesting, the Baron traditionally allowed his people a holiday. Every year, at this time, the travelling fair came to the castle and set up its booths and stalls. There were fire-eaters and jugglers, singers and storytellers. There were stalls where you could attempt to win prizes by throwing soft leather balls at pyramids made from bottle-shaped pieces of wood, or by throwing hoops over squares. Will sometimes thought that the squares were perhaps just a little larger than the hoops that one was given to throw, and he had never actually seen anyone win one of the prizes. But it was all fun, and the Baron paid for it from his own purse. Right now, however, Will was not concerned with the fair and its attractions. There would be time later in the day for that. At the moment, he was on his way to meet his former wardmates. By tradition, all the craftmasters gave their apprentices the day off on harvest day, even though they had taken no part in the actual harvest themselves. Will had been wondering for weeks whether or not Holt would conform to the practice. The ranger seemed to take no notice of tradition and had his own way of doing things. But 2 nights before, his anxiety had been settled. Holt had gruffly told him that he could have the holiday, adding that he would probably forget everything that he had learned in the past 3 months. Those 3 months had been a time of constant practice with his bow and the knives that Holt had given him. 3 months of stalking through the fields outside the castle, moving from one scant patch of cover to the next, trying to make his way unobserved by Holt's eagle eyes. 3 months of riding and caring for Tug, of forming a special bond of friendship with the little pony. That, he thought, had been the most enjoyable part of it all. Now he was ready for a holiday, and ready to enjoy himself a little. Even the thought that Horace would be there couldn't dim the pleasure. Maybe, he thought, a few months' hard training in battle school had changed Horace's aggressive manner a little. It was Jenny who had arranged the meeting for the holiday, encouraging the others to join her, with the promise of a batch of fresh mince pies that she would bring from the kitchen. She was already one of Master Chubb's prize pupils, and he boasted of her artistry to anyone who would listen, giving suitable emphasis to the vital role his training had played in developing her skill. Of course. Will's stomach grumbled with pleasure at the thought of those pies. He was starving, since he had intentionally gone without breakfast so as to leave room for them. Jenny's pies were already legendary in Castle Redmond. He had arrived at the meeting point early, so he dismounted and led Tug into the shade of an apple tree.
The little pony craned his head and looked wistfully at the apples on the branches, well out of his reach. Will grinned at him and scrambled quickly up the tree, picking an apple and handing it to the pony.
"That's all you get," he said. "You know what Hort says about eating too much."
Tug shook his head impatiently. That was still a matter of disagreement between him and the ranger. Will looked around. There was no sign of the others, so he sat down in the shade of the tree, leaning his back against the knobby trunk to wait.
"Why, it's young Will, isn't it?" said a deep voice close behind him.
Will scrambled hastily to his feet and touched his forehead in a polite salute. It was Baron Arald himself, seated astride his giant battle horse and accompanied by several of his senior knights.
"Yes, sir," said Will nervously. He wasn't used to being addressed by the Baron. "A happy harvest day to you, sir."
The Baron nodded in acknowledgement and leaned forward, slouching comfortably in his saddle. Will had to crane his neck to look up at him.
"I must say, young man, you look quite the part there," the Baron said. "I hardly saw you in that grey ranger cloak. Has Hort been teaching you all his tricks already?"
Will glanced down at the grey and green mottled cloak that he was wearing. Hort had given it to him some weeks ago. He'd shown Will how the grey and green mottling broke up the shape of the wearer and helped him blend into the landscape. It was one of the reasons, he'd said, why rangers could move unseen with such ease.
"It's the cloak, sir," Will said. "Hort calls it camouflage."
The Baron nodded, obviously familiar with the term, which had been a new concept to Will.
"Just make sure you don't use it to steal more cakes," he said with mock severity, and Will shook his head hurriedly.
"Oh, no, sir," he said immediately. "Hort told me that if I did anything like that, he'd tan the skin off my back so—"
He stopped awkwardly. He wasn't sure if backside was the sort of word you used in the presence of someone as exalted as a baron. The Baron nodded again, trying not to let a wide grin break through.
"I'm sure he did," he said. "And how are you getting on with Hort, Will? Are you enjoying learning to be a ranger?"
Will paused. To be honest, he hadn't had time to think if he was enjoying himself or not. His days were too busy learning new skills, practicing with bow and knives, and working with Tug. This was the first time in 3 months he'd had a moment to actually think about it.
"I suppose so," he said hesitantly. "Only..."
His voice trailed off, and the Baron looked at him more closely.
"Only what?" he prompted.
Will shifted from one foot to the other, wishing that his mouth didn't continually get him into these situations by talking too much. Words had a way of emerging before he'd really had time to consider whether he wanted to say them or not.
"Only Hort never smiles at all," he went on awkwardly. "He's always so serious about things."
He had the impression that the Baron was suppressing another grin.
"Well," said Baron Arald, "being a ranger is a serious business, you know. I'm sure Hort has impressed that on you."
"All the time," Will said ruefully, and this time the Baron couldn't help smiling.
"Just pay attention to what he tells you, youngster," he said. "You're learning a very important job there."
"Yes, sir."
Will was a little surprised to realize that he did agree with the Baron. Baron Arald reached forward to gather up his reins. On an impulse, before the nobleman could ride away, Will stepped forward.
"Excuse me, sir," he said hesitantly, and the Baron turned back to him.
"Yes, Will," he asked.
Will shuffled his feet again, then went on.
"Sir, remember when our armies fought Morgarath?"
Baron Arald's cheerful face was clouded by a thoughtful frown.
"I'll not forget that in a hurry, boy," he said. "What about it?"
"Sir, Hort tells me that a ranger showed the cavalry a secret way across the slips under, so they were able to attack the enemy's rear."
That's true, said Harold.
I've been wondering, sir, what was the ranger's name?
Will finished, feeling himself flush with his boldness.
Didn't Holt tell you?
The Baron asked.
Will shrugged his shoulders. He said names weren't important. He said supper was important, but not names.
But you think names are important, in spite of what your master has told you?
Said the Baron, seeming to frown again.
Will gulped and went on.
I think it was Holt himself, sir, he said,
and I wondered why he hadn't been decorated or honoured for his skill.
The Baron thought for a moment, then spoke again.
Well, you're right, Will, he said. It was Holt, and I wanted to honour him for it, but he wouldn't allow me. He said that wasn't the ranger's way.
But, Will began in a perplexed tone, but the Baron's upraised hand stopped him from speaking any further.
You rangers have your own ways, Will, as I'm sure you're learning. Sometimes other people don't understand them. Just listen to Holt and do as he does, and I'm sure you'll have an honourable life ahead of you.
Yes, sir.
Will saluted again as the Baron slapped his reins lightly on his horse's neck and turned him away toward the fairground.
Now, enough of this, said the Baron. We can't chatter all day. I'm off to the fair. Maybe this year I'll get a hoop over one of those damned squares.
The Baron started to ride away. Then a thought seemed to strike him, and he reined in for a second.
Will,
he called back.
Yes, sir?
Don't tell Holt that I told you he led the cavalry. I don't want him angry at me.
16. Jenny, Alice and George arrived shortly after. As she had promised, Jenny was carrying a batch of fresh pies wrapped in a red cloth. She laid them carefully on the ground under the apple tree as the others crowded around. Even Alice, usually so poised and dignified, seemed anxious to get her hands on one of Jenny's masterpieces.
Come on, George said. I'm starving.
Jenny shook her head.
We should wait for Horace, she said,
looking around for him, but not seeing him in the passing crowds of people.
Oh, come on, George pleaded. I've been slaving over a hot petition to the Baron all morning.
Alice rolled her eyes to heaven. Perhaps we should start, she said. Otherwise, he'll begin a legal argument, and we'll be here all day. We can always put a couple aside for Horace.
Will grinned.
George was a different kettle of fish now to the shy, stammering boy at the choosing. Scribe school obviously had caused him to bloom. Jenny served out two pies each, setting two aside for Horace.
That'll do for starters, she said.
The others eagerly tucked in and soon began to chorus their praise for the pies. Jenny's reputation was well-founded.
This, said George, standing above them and spreading his arms wide as he addressed an imaginary court,
cannot be described as a mere pie, Your Honour. To describe this as a pie would be a gross miscarriage of justice, the like of which this court has never seen before.
Will turned to Alice. How long has he been like this?
He asked. She smiled. They all get this way with a few months' legal training. These days, the main problem with George is getting him to shut up.
Oh, sit down, George, said Jenny,
blushing at his praise, but delighted nonetheless.
You are a complete idiot.
Perhaps, my fair miss, but it is the sheer magic of these works of art that has turned my brain. These are not pies. These are symphonies. He raised his remaining half-pie to the others in a mock toast. I give you Miss Jenny's Symphony of Pies.
Alice and Will, grinning at each other and at George, raised their own pies in response and echoed the toast. Then all four apprentices burst out laughing.
It was a pity that Horace chose that precise moment to arrive. Alone among them, He was miserable in his new situation. The work was hard and unremitting, and the discipline was unwavering. He'd expected that, of course, and under normal circumstances he could have handled it. But being the focus for Bryn, Alder and Jerome's spite was making his life a nightmare, literally. The 3 second-year cadets would rouse him from his bed at all hours of the night, dragging him out to perform the most humiliating and exhausting tasks. The lack of sleep and the worry of never knowing when they might appear to torment him further was causing him to fall behind in his classroom work. His roommates, sensing that if they showed any sympathy for him, they might become targets along with him, had cast him adrift, so that he felt totally alone in his misery. The one thing he had always aspired to was rapidly becoming ashes in his mouth. He hated battle school, but he could see no way out of his predicament without embarrassing and humiliating himself even further. Now, on the one day when he could escape from the restrictions and the tensions of battle school, he arrived to find his former wardmates already busy at their feast, and he was angry and hurt that they hadn't bothered to wait for him. He had no idea that Jenny had set some of the pies aside for him. He assumed that she had divided them up already, and that hurt more than anything. Of all his former wardmates, she was the one he felt closest to. Jenny was always cheerful, always friendly, always willing to listen to another's troubles. He realized that he'd been looking forward to seeing her again today, and now he felt that she had let him down. He was predisposed to think badly of the others. Alice had always seemed to hold herself aloof from him, as if he weren't good enough for her, and Will had spent his time playing tricks on him, then running away and climbing into that immense tree where Horace couldn't follow. At least, that was how Horace saw things in his current vulnerable state. He conveniently forgot the times he had cuffed Will over the ear, or held him in a headlock until the smaller boy was forced to cry, "Yield!" As for George, Horace had never taken much notice of him. The thin boy was studious and devoted to his books, and Horace had always considered him a pallid, uninteresting person. Now here he was performing for them while they laughed and ate the pies and left nothing for him, and suddenly he hated them all. "Well, this is very nice, isn't it?" he said bitterly. And they turned to him, the laughter dying on their faces. As was inevitable, Jenny was the first one to recover. "Horace, you're here at last," she said. She started toward him, but the cold look on his face stopped her. "At last," he said. "I'm a few minutes late, and suddenly I'm here at last, and just too late because you've already pigged out on all the pies." Which was hardly fair to poor Jenny. Like most cooks, once she had prepared a meal, she had little interest in eating it. Her real pleasure lay in watching others enjoy the results of her work, and listening to their praise. Consequently, she hadn't had any of the pies. She turned back now to the two that she had covered in a napkin to keep for him. "No, no," she said quickly. "There are still some left. Look." But Horace's pent-up anger prevented him from acting or speaking rationally. "Well," he said, in a voice heavy with sarcasm, "maybe I ought to come back later and give you time to finish them as well." "Horace!" Tears sprang to Jenny's eyes. She had no idea what was wrong with Horace. All she knew was that her plan for a pleasant reunion with her old wardmates was falling in ruins. George stepped forward now, peering curiously at Horace. The tall, thin boy cocked his head to one side to study the apprentice warrior more closely, as if he were an exhibit or a piece of evidence in a law court. "There's no call to be so unpleasant," he said reasonably. But reason wasn't what Horace wanted to hear. He shoved the other boy aside angrily. "Get away from me," he said.
And mind how you talk to a warrior.
You're not a warrior yet, Will told him scornfully. You're still only an apprentice, like the rest of us.
Jenny made a small gesture with her hands, urging Will to drop the matter. Horace, who was in the act of helping himself to the remaining pies, looked up slowly. He measured Will up and down for a second or two.
"Oh-ho!" he said. "I see the apprentice spy is with us today."
He looked to see if the others were laughing at his wit. They weren't, and it only served to make him more unpleasant.
"I suppose Hort is teaching you to slink around, spying on everyone, is he?"
Horace stepped forward, without waiting for an answer, and fingered Will's mottled cloak sarcastically.
"What's this? Didn't you have enough dye to make it all one colour?"
"It's a ranger cloak," Will said quietly, holding down the anger that was building inside him. Horace snorted scornfully, cramming half of one of the pies into his mouth and spraying crumbs as he did so.
"Don't be so unpleasant," George said.
Horace rounded on the apprentice scribe, his face red.
"Watch your tongue, boy," he snapped. "You're talking to a warrior, you know."
"An apprentice warrior," Will repeated firmly, laying stress on the word apprentice.
Horace went redder and looked angrily between the two of them. Will tensed himself, sensing that the bigger boy was about to launch an attack. But there was something in Will's eyes and his ready stance that made Horace think twice about it. He had never seen that look of defiance before. In the past, if he'd threatened Will, he had always seen fear. This newfound confidence unsettled him a little. Instead, he turned back to George and gave him a heavy shove in the chest.
"How's that for unpleasant?" he said, as the tall, thin boy staggered back.
George's arms windmilled as he tried to save himself from falling. Accidentally, he struck Tug a glancing blow on the side. The little pony, grazing peacefully, reared suddenly against his bridle.
"Steady, Tug," Will said, and Tug quieted immediately.
But now Horace had noticed him for the first time. He stepped forward and looked more closely at the shaggy pony.
"What's this?" he asked in mock disbelief. "Has someone brought a big ugly dog to the party?"
Will clenched his fists.
"He's my horse," he said quietly.
He could put up with Horace sneering at him, but he wasn't going to stand by and see his horse insulted.
Horace let out a braying laugh. "A horse," he said. "That's not a horse. In the battle school, we ride real horses, not shaggy dogs. Looks like he needs a good bath to me, too."
He wrinkled his nose and pretended to sniff closer to Tug. The pony glanced sideways at Will.
"Who is this unpleasant clod?" his eyes seemed to say.
Then Will, carefully hiding the wicked grin that was trying to show on his face, said casually,
"He's a ranger horse. Only a ranger can ride him."
Horace laughed again.
"My grandmother could ride that shaggy dog."
"Maybe she could," said Will, "but I'll bet you can't."
Before he'd even finished the challenge, Horace was untying the bridle. Tug looked at Will, and the boy could have sworn the horse nodded slightly. Horace swung himself easily up onto Tug's back. The pony stood, unmoving.
"Nothing to it," Horace crowed.
Then he dug his heels into Tug's sides.
"Come on, doggy, let's have a run."
Will saw the familiar preparatory bunching of muscles in Tug's legs and body. Then the pony sprang into the air off all 4 feet, twisted violently, came down on his front legs and shot his hindquarters high into the air. Horace flew like a bird for several seconds. Then he crashed flat on his back in the dust. George and Alice looked on in delighted disbelief as the bully lay there for a second or two, stunned and winded. Jenny went to step forward to see if he was all right. Then her mouth set in a determined line, and she stopped. Horace had asked for it, she thought. There was a chance then, just a chance, that the whole incident might end there. But Will couldn't resist the temptation to have one last word.
"Maybe you'd better ask your grandmother if she'll teach you to ride," he said, straight-faced.
George and Alice managed to hide their smiles, but unfortunately, it was Jenny who couldn't stop the small giggle that escaped her. In an instant, Horace scrambled to his feet, his face dark with rage. He looked around, saw a fallen branch from the apple tree, and grabbed it, brandishing it over his head as he rushed at Tug.
"I'll show you and your damned horse!" he yelled furiously, swinging the stick wildly at Tug.
The pony danced sideways out of harm's way, and, before Horace could strike again, Will was on him. He landed on Horace's back, and his weight and the force of his leap drove them both to the ground. They rolled there, grappling with each other, each trying to gain an advantage. Tug, alarmed to see his master in danger, whinnied nervously and reared. One of Horace's wildly flailing arms caught Will a ringing blow across the ear. Then Will managed to get his right arm free and punched Horace hard in the nose. Blood ran down the bigger boy's face. Will's arms were hard and well-muscled after his 3 months' training with Holt. But Horace was being taught in a hard school too. He drove a fist into Will's stomach, and Will gasped as the air was driven out of him. Horace scrambled to his feet, but Will, in a move that Holt had shown him, swung his own legs in a wide arc, cutting Horace's feet from under him and sending him tumbling again. "Always strike first," Holt had dinned into his brain in the hours they'd spent practicing unarmed combat. Now, as the other boy crashed to the ground again, Will dived upon him, trying to pin his arms beneath his knees. Then Will felt an iron grip on the back of his collar, and he was being hauled in the air, like a fish upon a hook, wriggling and protesting.
"What's going on here, you two hooligans?" said a loud, angry voice in his ear.
Will twisted around and realized that he was being held by Sir Rodney, the battlemaster, and the big warrior looked extremely angry. Horace scrambled to his feet and stood at attention. Sir Rodney released Will's collar, and the ranger's apprentice dropped to the ground like a sack of potatoes. Then he, too, stood to attention.
"Two apprentices," said Sir Rodney angrily, "brawling like hooligans and spoiling the holiday. And to make things worse, one of them is my own apprentice."
Will and Horace shuffled their feet, eyes down, unable to meet the battlemaster's furious gaze.
"All right, Horace, what's going on here?"
Horace shuffled his feet again and went red. He didn't answer. Sir Rodney looked at Will.
"All right, you, the ranger's boy. What's this all about?"
Will hesitated. "Just a fight, sir," he mumbled.
"I can see that," the battlemaster shouted. "I'm not an idiot, you know."
He paused for a moment, waiting to see if either boy had anything further to add. They were both silent. Sir Rodney sighed in exasperation. "Boys, if they weren't getting under your feet, they were fighting. And if they weren't fighting, they were stealing or breaking something."
"All right," he said finally. "The fight's over. Now shake hands and be done with it."
He paused and, as neither boy made a move to shake hands, roared in his parade ground voice,
"Get on with it!"
Galvanized into action, Will and Horace reluctantly shook hands. But as Will looked into Horace's eyes, he saw that the matter was far from settled. "We'll finish this another time," the angry look in Horace's eyes said.
"Any time you like," the apprentice ranger's eyes replied.
17. Snow lay thick on the ground as Will and Holt rode slowly home from the forest. The situation between Will and Horace remained unresolved as time had passed. There had been little chance for the two boys to resume the argument, as their respective masters kept them busy and their paths seldom crossed. Will had seen the apprentice warrior occasionally, but always at a distance. They hadn't spoken or even had the chance to acknowledge each other's presence. But the ill feeling was still there, Will knew, and one day it would come to a head. Strangely, he found that the prospect didn't disturb him nearly as much as it might have a few months ago. It was not that he looked forward to renewing the fight with Horace, but he found he could face the idea with a certain amount of equanimity. He felt a deep satisfaction when he recalled that good, solid punch he had landed on Horace's nose. He also realized, with a slight sense of surprise, that the memory of the incident was made more enjoyable by the fact that it had happened in the presence of Jenny, and this was where the surprise lay. Alice. Inconclusive as the event might have been, there was still a lot about it to set Will thinking and remembering. But not right now, he realized, as Holt's angry tone dragged him back to the present. "Could we possibly continue with our tracking, or did you have something more important to do?" he inquired. Instantly, Will cast around, trying to see what Hort had pointed out. As they rode through the crisp white snow, their horses' hooves making only the smallest of sounds, Hort had been pointing to disturbances in the even white cover. They were tracks left by animals, and it was Will's task to identify them. He had sharp eyes and a good mind for the task. He normally enjoyed these tracking lessons, but now his attention had wandered, and he had no idea where he was supposed to be looking. "There," Holt said, his tone leaving no doubt that he didn't expect to have to repeat such things, as he pointed to the left. Will stood in his stirrups to see the disturbed snow more clearly. "Rabbit," he said promptly. Holt turned to look sidelong at him. "Rabbit?" he asked, and Will looked again, correcting himself almost immediately. "Rabbits," he said, stressing the plural ending. Holt insisted on accuracy.
"I should think so," Holt muttered at him. "After all, if they were Scandian tracks there, you'd need to be sure you knew how many there were."
"I suppose so," said Will meekly.
"You suppose so?"
Holt replied sarcastically.
"Believe me, Will, there's a big difference between knowing there's one Scandian about and knowing that there are half a dozen."
Will nodded apologetically. One of the changes that had come over their relationship lately was the fact that Holt almost never referred to him as boy any more. These days it was always Will. Will liked that. It made him feel that somehow he'd been accepted by the grim-faced ranger. All the same, he did wish that Hort would smile once or twice when he said it. Or even once. Hort's low voice snapped him out of his daydreaming.
"So, rabbits, is that all?"
Will looked again. In the disturbed snow, difficult to see, but there, now that Holt had pointed it out to him, was another set of tracks.
"A stout," he said triumphantly, and Holt nodded again.
"A stout," he agreed. "But you should have known there was something else there, Will. Look at how deep those rabbit tracks are. It's obvious that something had frightened them. When you see a sign like that, it's a hint to look for something extra."
"I see," said Will, but Holt shook his head.
"No, all too often you don't see, because you don't maintain your concentration. You'll have to work on that."
Will said nothing. He merely accepted the criticism. He'd learned by now that Holt didn't criticize without reason. And when there was reason, no amount of excuses could save him. They rode on in silence. Will strained his eyes at the ground around them, looking for more tracks, more animal signs. They went another kilometre or so, and was starting to see some of the familiar landmarks that told him he was close to their cottage when he saw something. "Look!" he cried, pointing to a tumbled section of snow just off the path. "What's that?"